What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Hidden Forces with me, Dimitri Kafinas. Today, we speak with writer, commentator, and chronicler of financial and economic history, Sebastian Mallaby. Sebastian is Paul A. Volcker's Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council on Foreign Relations and a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. His interests cover a wide variety of domestic and international issues, including central banks, financial markets, and the intersection of economics and international relations. Some of his books include More Money Than God, Hedge Funds, and The Making of a New Elite, The World's Banker, and The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. In this episode, we take a trip down Maiden Lane to the bond desk of the New York Fed and beyond to Constitution Avenue and to the headquarters of one of the most powerful institutions ever devised, the Federal Reserve System. Our story begins in the early spring of 1926, during the Roaring Twenties, and follows the story of one man whose life and career paralleled and in many ways defined the evolution and transformation of the American economy. From the depths of the Great Depression in the 1930s, through the stagflation of the 1970s, the tech boom of the late 90s, and culminating finally in the financial crisis of 2008. Alan Greenspan is one of the most consequential and yet least understood figures in American history. A libertarian turned technocrat, a self-described sideman who, nevertheless, managed to place himself front and center during one of the most crucial periods in the remaking of American finance. From his early days in politics as an active supporter of Barry Goldwater to his later years as a fixture in the Ford administration and as an advisor to Ronald Reagan, Alan Greenspan's role in public policy long predates his almost 20-year tenure as chairman of the Federal Reserve. That chairmanship lasted from the crisis of 1987 all the way through to the peak of the American housing market in 2006. How responsible was he for the prosperity of the 1990s, and how much is he to blame for the catastrophic financial meltdown of 2008? Most importantly, what can the story of Alan Greenspan, one brilliant yet highly fallible human being, teach us about the limits and the dangers of human intervention, foresight, and power? As always, you can gain access to reading lists put together by me ahead of every episode by visiting the show's website at hiddenforcespod.com. Lastly, if you are listening to the show on iTunes or Android, make sure to subscribe. If you like the show, write us a review. And if you want a sneak peek into how the sausage is made, or for special storylines told through pictures and questions, then like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod. And now, time for this week's conversation. So, Sebastian, thank you so much for coming on today.
Good to be with you.
Very excited to have you on. Very, very excited. So, I read your entire book, really great, and I want to cover all of it or as much of it as possible. And I also want to try to get into the subject of central banking in general and sort of outlooks and things like that. But I want to start with Alan Greenspan, and I want to start really with these two myths that I think you expose in the book, one of which is that Greenspan was incompetent or that he didn't know. That's one myth that's sort of perpetuated in the media, that he didn't really understand or see the bubble that was forming or really be qualified to understand what it was. I mean, we'll get into that, the wealth effect, et cetera. Another myth is the idea that it was his stance on regulation and his lack of interest in regulating the banks and the financial system, and not so much his monetary policy, that was his biggest failure. And of course, the name of your book is The Man Who Knew, which I think speaks to that sort of idea that, in fact, he knew, and he knew quite a great deal, as we learned from just reading his PhD thesis, which you read. And in fact, you've gone through. So why don't you tell us? I mean, you did a tremendous amount of research. How many hours did you spend just you and Alan Greenspan together?
I would go see him every week or two, spend a couple of hours with him. And after about 70 hours of taped conversations, I just quit counting because it seemed pointless after that. But it was essentially limitless access over 5 years.
Wow. And so in person, was he more discernible than he is in his public musings?
No, he would often meander and speak at length and not always on the point. He could be very lucid, actually, and transient in his writings when he was a younger man. He would be quite pointed. You know, he was a student of Ayn Rand, the famous Russian libertarian novelist. And she had a real way with words, a way of going to the jugular in an argument. I think he picked up some rhetorical techniques from that. And he could, at that point, in his 30s, 40s, and 50s, be, you know, he had the skills of an op-ed columnist, which is what he did part of the time. He wrote in the media, he commentated on TV and on radio. So at that point, he was pretty trenchant. I think with the passage of time, he learned as a central banker that vagueness can be an asset because you don't want to give away what you're going to do.
Well, that's something I want to talk to you about because that's kind of the forward guidance innovation that he did. This notion that you can control and influence rates without necessarily conducting open market operations. You can talk the rate down or talk it up. And I think he innovated in that regard. And he was certainly, I think, the most effective that we've known of. And he had, of course, a celebrity status that he cultivated, the briefcase indicator, of course, that CNBC used. But what about this first myth, this notion that he didn't know, which is, I mean, I think it's something that you've spoken about, if I'm not mistaken. Where do you think Greenspan stands on that? And one thing we can even discuss is, and you cited in your book, his speech before the American Statistical Association in 1959, where he talked about asset bubbles. He talked essentially about the wealth effect, and he talked essentially about home equity extraction, which I thought was remarkable. I mean, I never thought the man was ignorant. I thought that, and I was familiar with his comments on gold in the 1960s, but that was, to me, even more significant.
Right. I mean, I think there is a view of the 2008 crisis, which goes as follows. It says, we had a crisis because the guys in charge, with Greenspan at the center, were naive believers in the self-policing efficiency of financial markets. And because they had this naive belief that you could just do laissez-faire and it will be fine, of course the system blew up because they weren't trying to regulate it or think about it or worry about instant instability. And the biggest sort of intellectual revelation in my 5 years of research on Greenspan was that he had been minutely obsessed with financial instability going back to the 1950s, going back to when he was in his 30s. And the speech that you're talking about, the 1959 address to the American Statistical Association, which was kind of the forerunner of the American Economics Association, which has famous meetings every year, you know, that was really about the way that business cycles, which had conventionally been understood to be about, you know, the real economy overheating, you know, factories produce too much, there's an inventory buildup, there's this pile of stuff waiting to be sold, and so then, you know, there's too much, so the factory stops suddenly making things, and then people get laid off, and that creates a recession. He said, wait, you know, that's true, but there's a way bigger effect on the business cycle, which derives from financial markets. When asset prices go up, everybody's excited, everybody goes out and invests, that investment drives growth, and if it crashes, the opposite happens. The crash from finance will have terrible effects on the real economy. And he was very early in thinking about that, writing about that. And it shows that for this early point, he was the man who knew. He was the man who understood that financial fragility could not be taken for granted and that if it went wrong, it would be consequential.
You know, that's interesting because when I was reading the book, one of the things I noticed that I had not appreciated. So there's actually a very interesting arc in the thinking about inflation as it evolved over the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. On the one side, there is the cost push, demand pull versus monetary policy argument, the sort of evolution that happened with Milton Friedman and that whole idea, and what drives inflation in the economy. And then the other one was, in my opinion, not necessarily was, is, or it sort of just kind of happened. Inflation was not thought of by central bankers or economists at large as having to do with asset prices. They saw inflation entirely as a consumer price phenomenon. When they referred to what I consider asset price inflation, or what I think now more broadly people consider asset price inflation, it sounds like what they were really talking about was financial stability. That's how they referred to it. And I think that's an interesting thing. And so When Alan Greenspan was talking about asset price inflation, I mean, to me, do you feel that he understood Because even Greenspan in his writings and certainly in his public musings used that term about, are we concerned about financial stability? Do we focus on inflation? Did he understand that? And I think one area where I think this is poignant is because he gets a lot of credit in the 1990s for having spotted the change in productivity and the fact that the productivity was that CPI was overstating inflation because of productivity gains. And he was a strong advocate of reforming the way we measured CPI and hedonic pricing, for example. But what I wonder about is, did he not see that, yes, CPI may be overstated. However, if you're going to expand monetary policy and if you're going to have globalization where you have excess savings coming in from abroad, driving down interest rates, and you've got excess savings driving down consumer costs, which give people more money to spend, that's not going to go somewhere, and that it's not going to go into asset markets. And therefore, even though he gets a lot of credit for having spotted that intellectually, absolutely, but didn't that just juice up asset prices in the 90s and much more? And then, of course, the 2000s is a separate issue entirely. But that's a convoluted way, but I think you do understand where I'm going with it.
I mean, this gets to the very big sort of policy finding that comes out of my 5 years of research. You know, in studying Greenspan, one studies the tragedy of somebody who understood that asset price overshoots could be dangerous, that stock market bubbles could be dangerous. Yet he was this man who knew, but he was not the man who acted. And so this thing blew up in his face twice, right? Once when the NASDAQ bubble blew up in 2000, and then a second time, of course, right after he retired with the with the subprime mortgage bubble. So how do you get a man who understands financial instability and yet presides over these two disastrous bubbles? Mm. That's the central mystery that I think modern central bankers have yet to really grapple with. And I go around the country these days and speak to the regional Fed banks and do stuff for their staff and so forth. And I always challenge them to say, look, the last two business cycles in the United States have come to an end because of asset price bubbles. The next one will probably follow the same pattern. What are you guys doing about it? And they don't have a good answer.
They don't have a good answer.
No. The answer that they tend to give is, well, we'll try and fight it with regulation. You know, if we see a bubble building up, there's too much debt going on, we'll give some guidance to the banks to lend a bit less. And my point emerging from my research is that was actually tried in the 2000s, more than people realize. You know, Greenspan and the Fed tried to clamp down on Fannie and Freddie, the big housing lenders. They tried to do something about crazy subprime mortgages. It didn't work. Why didn't it work? Because in America, you can always get around regulations because there's this huge, chaotic alphabet soup of different regulatory bodies coming out of the federal government. And so you can always forum shop from one to the next until you get your loophole where you can do some crazy stuff. So I don't think financial regulation will prevent the next blow up. So if you want to prevent it, you need to be willing to raise interest rates, even when inflation isn't that high. And that's, right now in 2017, you've got Janet Yellen raising interest rates very, very cautiously at the Fed because she says, well, look, inflation is still under control. Why should I raise any faster? But the fact is that the stock market has had a huge run up in the first months after Trump's election. And I think it's getting into bubble territory. And if she carries on being super cautious about how far she raises interest rates, as you say, the money that's coming into the economy, the credit that's being created, will end up in financial asset prices. And that will end in tears.
I'm not surprised with what you say about central bankers. I had Alan Blinder, who you mentioned in your book, on my old program, and I asked him some poignant questions about monetary policy, and I came to the same sort of conclusion. And I think that's a conclusion that Alan Greenspan drew. Again, young Alan Greenspan to me made a lot of sense, and I think it's a conclusion he drew in his advocacy for a commodity standard. I think that was his whole point, which was that you can't trust individuals to manage interest rates. And I think that is a fundamental issue because now you talk about Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie had a lot of money to run advertisements in congressional districts. In addition, Ben Bernanke was out on CNBC in 2005 or 2006 saying that he just didn't buy the premise that we were in a housing bubble. Housing never, quote, never declines nationwide. So, I mean, these are fallible people. We're all fallible. And so I think that speaks to many of those issues. I also think we are in a different beast this time around with our financial mess. I think one of the ways I think of it sometimes is that I ask the question to myself, have we hit peak credit? Have we hit a place where the mechanism is broken?
Well, first of all, I mean, let me just knit together what I think we've been both saying in the last few minutes, which is to say that if it's the case that Alan Greenspan was the man who knew, it means that 2008 crisis did not happen because he was dumb or ignorant. It happened because of something else. And I want to insist on this point that modern policymakers need to grapple with what that something else was. And I think there's something else that, you know, they will not agree to run monetary policy targeted partly at asset bubbles. If you only care about the price of eggs and you don't care about the price of Nest eggs, the Nest eggs are going to go crazy, right? And you'll have another bubble.
That's a great way to put it.
So I wanted to just sort of wrap, you know, kind of underscore that point. Now, on this thing about peak credit, it's an intriguing idea. Clearly, you know, I have a chart at the back of my book which shows how leverage in the U.S. economy just balloons. You know, it starts going up in the late 60s. It goes up gradually. In the 80s, it just takes off. And then in the 90s, even more. Huge amounts of shadow banking debt and what have you.
Oh, absolutely.
And now, have we reached a peak? Well, I think part of the answer has to do with what goes on with the Trump regulation rethink. You know, whether something comes out of that which fundamentally loosens the constraints. Because I think that, you know, the Dodd-Frank reforms have scared banks, have clamped down on what they do, have caused them to spin off some of their prop trading to hold a lot more capital. And all of that has constrained the growth of credit. And, you know, if we have a different regulatory climate going forward, which I think is not a done deal, because I think, you know, Congress has shown plenty of scope for burying Trump's proposals. But if he gets some of what he talked about in the campaign, a fundamentally more deregulatory environment around credit creation, then we could see, I think, credit going up again.
Mm. Well, I want to continue on that. Something else I'll say is I want to actually not finish your point, which was, why, despite the fact that he was the man who knew, was he willing to preside over these asset bubbles and to conduct? I think the first, you know, in the reading for me, when I look at the his tenure, of course, he came in 1987. He dealt with that crash, Black Monday, this sort of the need, in addition to the crash, the need to really assert himself as being someone that was credible on inflation in the manner that Paul Volcker was. Because it's important to remember that Greenspan was coming in when there was still strong fear and memory of the stagflation of the 1970s. And of course, Volcker was this Old Testament, you know, fire and brimstone central banker. Curmudgeon. I mean, I have a friend actually I was speaking to yesterday about this, and we were talking about this thing about, because I thought, you know, I think Greenspan just, he was a guy that he wanted to be liked. He liked the celebrity status. He didn't want to take the punch bowl away. He wanted to keep the party going. But Volcker was just fine breaking it. He didn't just mind taking it away. He could crush it. He didn't mind it. It was his role. He was the perfect guy for that period. And I think in that sense, he's earned his legend status. But I think that, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, I think my personal takeaway is that at the end of the day, Greenspan knew what he knew, and I think he knew deep down, my sense is he knew deep down that what he was doing was precarious, and I think he kind of found himself in a situation where he had to keep kind of doubling down on interest rates. And I think that for me, what I saw as the big turnaround was sometime around the 1995, 1996, with the irrational exuberance speech, and then with his, that was where I feel like monetary policy changed. I mean, before then, you saw, of course, he raised rates when he came in, he dropped them a little bit again, he raised them again, and then there was that period where he dropped them, and pretty much after that, he never really raised interest rates again. Tell me about that period. Am I onto something there in 1995, 96?
Yeah, it's very gratifying when, you know, somebody's absorbed the book so well that they've exactly nailed it, because I think there was that transition. I would say the key time was right after the irrational exuberance speech in late 1996, when he called the stock market. He said it's a bit high. He questioned the level. And then the market kind of dipped for a day and went up again. And after that, I think he just backed off and said, it's just not worth risking my reputation fighting the market. And technology and globalization have both caused price inflation to be very subdued. So I'm just going to ride this party. I'm going to have low interest rates. There won't be inflation, so that'll be fine. And if there's a stock market bubble, I'll just say, hey, you know, that's not my mandate. That's not what the central bank's supposed to do. And I'll just clean up after the bubble is burst. And in that point, you know, he was encouraged by the 1987 experience where Black Monday happened. The stock market was down 23% in one day. and the Fed did some dramatic actions, some dramatic loosening, and basically cushioned the economy through that shock. So he figured he could do that again and get away with it. So I think you're right that after the mid-90s, he was essentially a dovish chairman. What's interesting is that he'd been a hawk earlier on. And the key period to think about here, which I think is actually relevant to...
Earlier on, you're saying 1970s and before?
No, actually, I mean the period from when he took over the Fed in 1987 until the mid-90s. So basically roughly the first half or slightly less than half of his 18-year tenure. In this period, you know, George H.W. Bush and his team were really pushing him to cut interest rates more aggressively. And they got pretty down and dirty about this. You know, Richard Dahman, who was the Bush budget director, would go around Washington trying to discredit Greenspan to bully him into cutting interest rates. He would say stuff like, Alan Greenspan, 65 years old, lives all by himself, calls his mother every day. Is this a bit creepy? Does it remind you of Alfred Hitchcock's movie Psycho? And so there was real attempts to arm twist Greenspan into being friendlier to the White House, cutting rates more. And Greenspan refused. He was a street fighter. When it came to political darts, he could leak stories to the Wall Street Journal better than the administration could. He could make his opponents look dumb. He could go to Congress and lobby to get the Treasury's legislation blocked. So he proved himself to be more of an adept political actor. And my argument about Janet Yellen now is if Trump does attack the Fed in the next year or so, which I think is quite possible, she needs to be a street fighter too. She needs to study the Greenspan model of how you push back.
Can she be, you think?
You know, in some ways it's tough because Greenspan, one of the things about him was that, you know, he was the last great bipartisan figure in Washington. He had very close ties amongst the Democrats and amongst...
Well, he got along better with the Clinton administration than any other administration.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Certainly at the end of the second Bush administration was not a pretty period for him.
Right. His best period was the Clinton administration, and that speaks to your point that although he was a Republican, he got along best with the Clinton team. And in terms of his relationships on the Hill in Congress, that's where it was very balanced, which was a huge strength for him. So he could speak to both sides and get legislation blocked by friends on both sides. Didn't matter how the midterm elections would go one year. You know, if the other party got in, fine, he could still pull strings. Janet Yellen is way more identified as a classic Democrat. In fact, a liberal Democrat. In fact, a Berkeley liberal Democrat.
Yeah.
And I think that restricts her ability to fight political battles in Washington.
Well, she's also the second academic at the Fed. Greenspan was, in fact, a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
And Volcker was, although he had long served in government, he was, of course, an economist at the Chase Bank, if I remember correctly, out of the Rockefeller Bank.
Yellen, I mean, just on this point, I mean, she did, you know, serve on the board of the Fed way back in the 90s. Then she was the president of the San Francisco Fed. So she's been around the top of the Fed, including the politics of the top of the Fed, you know, for 20 years. So one shouldn't underestimate her ability in that sense. But I think that Greenspan was an unusually canny political operator. One of the things I enjoyed sort of unveiling in my book is the way that, you know, in his earlier years, Greenspan would fight pitch battles with Henry Kissinger.
Right. I love that part of the book.
In the 1970s. And Kissinger and he would go up against each other. And one day there'd be a New York Times story saying, basically, if I paraphrase the headline, Henry Kissinger acts without understanding what the heck he's doing. And Kissinger turned around to his deputy and said, where did this negative story in the New York Times come from? And the deputy said, Alan Greenspan leaked that one to them. And Kissinger goes, oh, okay. You know, kind of just like, of course Greenspan would do that.
Was he, so that's also speaking to something else, which is that Greenspan was, he was a passive-aggressive person in terms of how he managed confrontation. He didn't like open confrontation, but he really was committed to achieving power, achieving status, achieving his objectives. He was clear about his goals and clear about how badly he wanted them. And it is impressive. Now, of course, Kissinger is Kissinger. I mean, so there's something interesting about that. When you write about it, I do wonder to what extent was it sort of, it felt a little bit like Greenspan was little brother versus bigger brother Kissinger, who at the end of the day, you know, he didn't really see Greenspan as a threat, more as a nuisance. I mean, what was that really, that relationship like? It doesn't seem ultimately that, because Kissinger was, I mean, NSA Secretary of State at the same time. I mean, he's a powerful figure, remains powerful.
Well, you know, I tease my friend Neil Ferguson, who was writing a two-volume biography of Kissinger. I say, Neil, 2 volumes? I mean, your guy, how long was he in power for? And the answer is 8 years. He was Secretary of State or National Security Advisor for 8 years. Greenspan was chairman of the Fed for 18 and a half years. Yeah. So I think in the grand sweep of post-war history, Greenspan is by far the bigger figure, you know, because just by the length of time he was there. And if you add up the Fed period with the time when Greenspan was Gerald Ford's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, you get 21 years at the top of public life, which is an extraordinary record.
Well, let's talk about, okay, this is something I wanted to get to, but we might as well just kind of start to cover it now. There's just so much, such an interesting arc. I mean, in terms of relationships, for me, the three most interesting, of course, there is, you know, his relationship with Nixon, his relationship with Ford, his relationship, some interesting back and forth with Reagan. I love, absolutely love, and I do want to ask you, did Greenspan tell you himself his conversation with Margaret Thatcher at that dinner where she asked him, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, or whatever, not Mr. Chairman, whatever it was at the time, why is it that we in Britain don't measure M3? I love the fact that that was in the book, because that is also, you know, that's such a hard money idea. Who else would ask, why don't we measure this particular monetary aggregate, which captures more inflation? And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. But there's, and to me, the three most interesting relationships in the book were his relationship to Kissinger, of course, his relationship to Barbara Walters, which just is such a stand-in for his relationship at large with the press, at large with society, culture, and celebrity, and his ability to influence in so many different ways. And I really, you know, for me, I don't know that other people would necessarily feel this way, but I really like the stuff with Pat Buchanan, because Pat Buchanan is such an interesting character. And of course, people, you know, I think today people don't a lot of people don't really know much about Pat Buchanan and what a really up and coming guy he was in the 1970s and what an important role he played in the Nixon campaign. And of course, Pat Buchanan, if I remember correctly, not from your book, but you mentioned it somewhere else, he actually provided a bunch of documents for you. Those were in Pat Buchanan's basement, right? So, you know, let's talk a little bit about that.
I mean, there were a huge number of wonderful research breakthroughs that I had in these 5 years, which is what made it so much fun. I mean, you know, you mentioned the Margaret Thatcher conversation, and the quick answer on that is that, you know, Greenspan remembers that conversation and told me about it, but the key kicker came from Greenspan's ex-girlfriend, who had gone to his apartment to wait for him to come back from a separate dinner. And Greenspan showed up, you know, after this encounter with Margaret Thatcher, kind of grinning from ear to ear, almost bubbly. And she figured, whoa, he must have had an extra drink. What happened? You know, too much gin and tonic. And then she just realized that he was intoxicated by having met this hard money political leader. And I think that was the sort of the extra perspective from Greenspan's girlfriend is what turned that story into a winner.
And that also really speaks to the kind of nerd and geek he was, too. I mean, like, beyond all the other stuff, like, at his core, he really was a real geek about, like, hard money, libertarian ideas. I mean, he really loved that.
Yeah, I mean, another ex-girlfriend told me this story about how, you know, it was her birthday party and Greenspan showed up with a new copy of the U.S. Statistical Abstract, which had just come out that morning, and commandeered the only nice chair in the apartment and basically sat there reading it while the party went on about, you know.
I remember
he was that kind of guy. But on Buchanan, I mean, this is another fantastic research breakthrough, because Buchanan has 2 great things in his basement. You know, there's a fantastic collection of guns, antique firearms, right? That speaks to the cultural conservative in him. Also, there was, you know, the full set of Nixon campaign memos from 1967, 1968, when Buchanan was kind of a chief of staff come speechwriter figure. And Buchanan very much was Greenspan's ally in that campaign and saw to it that Greenspan was promoted. And he gave me access to the entire set that he had of Greenspan's memos to Nixon and to the campaign when, you know, in 67, 68, when Greenspan was acting as a sort of advisor on economics to Nixon. And what's amazing about reading that set of memos is you start off with straight economic advice. Then it becomes economic advice with a bit of politics. And then it becomes, you know, Greenspan by now is doing polling analysis for Nixon. And it becomes essentially just pure political analysis. And by the end, it's gone beyond political analysis and it's actually spin. He's saying, Mr. Candidate, Mr. Nixon, I know you think the following, but it's not going to go over well with the voters, especially in the South, so you should maybe say something else. You know, he's really message advising.
And his advice on RFK and RFK's speech.
That was amazing. I mean, right after John Kennedy was shot RFK, his brother, who was, of course, the Democratic front runner in that campaign in 1968, made a memorable speech about his brother's death, calling for unity amongst Americans in the wake of this tragedy. I'm sorry, it was actually Martin Luther King's death. It was in the wake of Martin Luther King's death. But he hearkened back to his brother's killing.
It's a beautiful speech. It's a very famous speech.
That's right.
On the back of a pickup truck, if I remember correctly. Or on some sort of, he stood on top of a truck and gave that speech. Yeah, very moving speech.
Yeah, and he'd had no time to prepare it. I mean, he'd heard the news of Martin Luther King's killing on the way to this Indianapolis area, and he kind of got there and made this fantastic speech. So everybody was very moved, and some people attributed the fact that Indianapolis did not experience race riots, unlike many other inner cities, to the fact that RFK had made this moving appeal for national unity. And Greenspan's response in a memo, which I got from Buchanan, was quite shocking, because essentially he said, you know, RFK is being opportunistic and we shouldn't let him piggyback on, you know, liberal guilt and so forth. And he took a pretty nasty line on RFK in that memo. So what you see there is that, you know, I thought I was going to write the biography of one of the great post-war financial statesmen. And Greenspan certainly was that. But I also turned out to be writing the biography of a very deeply political figure, a deeply Machiavellian figure, with a lust for power that I think he concealed to the world, but which was really strong underneath.
And you know, not so surprising. That was the thing I reflected after I read the book. I said, not surprising. How do you get to such a position? How do you stay for so long? I mean, these are, you know, at the end of the day, we love the idea of electing people that are not politicians. But if you're going to get elected, you've got to have strong political instincts. And he certainly did. And I like that you mentioned 68, because again, we talked about the 1995-96 transition that I saw, where he really, I saw a shift in his monetary, the way that he conducted monetary policy, the way he taught. And the other thing I want to ask you, by the way, I don't want to forget this, is to what extent do you think he really relied more on, and the markets really responded more to, his prognostications and to the aura he created around himself as being the oracle and the maestro, and less to actually whatever the bond desk was doing in New York with open market operations in the interest rate? I think that's an interesting thing, but that's a more technical question. I do want to go to it. But this 1960s period, I think, was also equally significant to the 1990s period in terms of, you know, the audience may not know this because we haven't talked about this in the book, but of course, Greenspan was a very successful businessman. And he made a lot of money. And in fact, he made enough money that he bought a really spiffy car that he would drive down the FDR Drive, I think it was, in New York. And so he kind of went through this period where he had a lot of financial success in the 50s. And then the 1960s, something happened with his introduction to Ayn Rand, and his just almost, he fell in love in a way with an ideological, I mean, he, of course, went to NYU. He already had strong beliefs that were non-Keynesian, pro-Austrian in a way. Certainly, he was much more attuned to the business cycle. But there was almost like a if you want to use the financial market analogy, there was a peak. There was a sort of a boom. And he, you know, full indoctrination into objectivism. Of course, he wrote in the Objectivist newsletter. And he was, of course, a fan and a supporter of Barry Goldwater. So, and then that changed rather rapidly. So you saw this sort of flame out into, I'm using this very highly quotation for lack of a better word, extremist ideas. And then you saw a quick pragmatic approach. And of course, Ayn Rand was one of a number of people in the movement that wasn't very happy about that. But that to me is very interesting. What do you think that was about? I mean, how did that, was that ultimately, do you think, well, two things. One, do you think that, because, of course, Alan Greenspan had that testimony to Congress where they asked him, you know, were you wrong? He goes, I found a flaw in my model, you know, but, you know, was it your ideology? And he said, you know, everyone has an ideology. And I just wondered, did this man need to experience a sort of visceral ideology at its core? Did he lust for this, a man who's so cerebral and so thoughtful, did he want to experience that sense of indoctrination? How did that transition happen between him being so sort of ideological to becoming a quick pragmatist politically?
I think the Nixon campaign was key here. I mean, he went into that as a libertarian idealist. And as I described, you know, by the end he was offering this very political advice. And he'd figured out that purely offering, you know, libertarian memos was just going to be ignored. Nixon just wouldn't listen. And if he wanted to be in the game, he needed to moderate what he was telling and sort of, you know, think, okay, so he'd been a consultant in business. My client now is the Republican presidential candidate. And what does the client want to hear? What will he actually act on? And so Greenspan started to offer advice that was kind of within the realm of what his client was going to be able to take on. And that was the transition to pragmatism and moderation, which, you know, then I think Greenspan, you know, being a highly intelligent person, was able to have two things going on in his head at once. You know, the ideal system that he preferred, which was still a gold standard libertarian, very small government vision. And on the other hand, the real world as he encountered it, which required him to put that all aside and operate within the rules of the game.
You mentioned the gold standard. There's some interesting stuff in your book with respect to how he approached the subject in the 1980s under the Reagan administration, because, of course, many of Reagan's supporters were advocates of a gold standard. He, I think, was it Reagan that commissioned or encouraged the gold commission in the early 80s to take a look at restoring the gold standard? And I think it was during that period, if I'm not mistaken, that Alan Greenspan proposed this idea of gold bonds as a, I thought, actually very ingenious and reasonable way to actually address the issue of transitioning back to gold. But ultimately, do you think that beyond simply the fact that once he became chairman, he didn't want to have a gold standard, obviously, because he's in control of the interest rate, but do you think that philosophically he changed in that position?
I do. I think there was a key transition which went kind of as follows. It's a bit tricky to get across, but I'm going to give it my best shot here. So essentially, what happened with the post-Second World War gold standard was that the theory was the dollar was linked to gold and other currencies were linked to the dollar, and everybody had to avoid inflation because otherwise, you know, if the US dollar has more inflation going on than, let's say, the German mark, then the exchange rate should adjust with the dollar getting weaker to compensate for that inflation difference. But in a gold standard, everything is pegged to each other, so you can't adjust. So therefore, you've got to avoid inflation. That was the premise of the whole Bretton Woods post-Second World War system. And what actually happened, starting with Lyndon Johnson and guns and butter and the Vietnam War and the Great Society spending programs, and then continuing even more with Nixon, was that politicians in the United States ignored that constraint and printed money, you know, created demand by having a budget deficit, bullied the Fed when it tried to raise interest rates to offset that. And so U.S.
Under Arthur Burns.
Yeah, and even before, a bit under Mitchell, when, you know, Lyndon Johnson, in a famous episode I recount in my book, you know, called the head of the Fed down to his ranch in Texas. And, you know, he shows up, there's this big room in Texas, nobody's there, he's getting a bit nervous. In comes the massive, tall Lyndon Johnson, starts pushing him around the room and saying, you know, boys are dying in Vietnam, you've got to cut interest rates. Boys are dying in Vietnam, you don't even care. And that intimidation, if you look at what actually Fed policy did, about 6 months after that, the Fed starts to get much looser. And the 1960s inflation starts to pick up from 66 onwards, and that's where the gold standard can't work anymore, because the gold standard only works if everybody controls inflation at the same, to the same extent. So by 1971, when the dollar left the gold standard in the Nixon shock, Greenspan's view was, we can't stay on the gold standard because we've allowed the inflation and we can't kid ourselves. I mean, that, you know, we need this adjustment in our exchange rate because we've had the inflation that requires it. So then he thought to himself, okay, so if politicians are irresponsible, gold is non-functional. So therefore, we need responsible politicians. But, and this is the key thing, if the politicians are actually responsible, we don't need the gold constraint. So the necessary condition for gold to work actually made gold obsolete. And so that's the transition from a gold standard to what I would call a PhD standard, a belief in sort of expert policymakers needing to wade into the public square, win arguments, and persuade politicians to run moderate, sensible macroeconomic policy. And in some ways, Greenspan's life and career was a successful struggle to persuade the political classes to embrace that macroeconomic responsibility. And it came to its, you know, kind of finest fruition in the 1990s when the Fed was de facto independent. You know, Clinton reduced the budget deficit and you got into this kind of great moderation golden period for U.S. economic performance, and the PhD standard triumphed.
That brings up another interesting question that I have, which is, to what extent were the 1990s and the Great Moderation really not the result of Alan Greenspan or the confidence he inspired or his interest rate policy, but in fact the conditions of the global economy, the globalization that was going on and the advanced, so two things, globalization and technological innovation?
Those were very important. I mean, globalization meant that you had this army of workers in China and other developing countries producing things way more cheaply than had been the case in the US. And so when you imported those goods from China, you essentially had a fall in prices, the sort of Walmart effect. And so, of course, if you're the central bank, that means inflation is lower and you can run interest rates lower and not worry about inflation. And technology was kind of a similar effect where, because of the introduction of computers and so forth, people could produce more in the same number of hours of work. And that meant that, you know, even if their wages went up a bit, their output was going up even more. And so companies could afford to cut prices and still make a profit because their workers had become more productive. And so these two forces, globalization and technological change, contributed a lot to the driving down of inflation through the 90s and to the stabilization around 2%. Now, it's not the full story. I mean, I think you do have to also give credit to Volcker and Greenspan for bringing down expectations of inflation by just showing that the Fed would raise interest rates if inflation showed any signs of looming its head. And that credibility of the central bank changed people's expectations. And that was another important element in bringing down inflation.
It was the perfect storm, in fact, yes. I do want to get to ask you some questions about Paul Volcker. By the way, did you read William Grider's book in preparation for this at all?
To be honest, I read bits of it. In some ways, it was a great book. I don't know if you've read it. But
I have, yeah, I have read it.
I found the sort of analytical lens through which he viewed the whole story a bit off-putting. You know, there's sort of a kind of conspiracy thing about these guys are all secretive and so forth.
Well, it was called Secrets of the Temple.
Yeah, that's right. I know. Yeah, so...
Well, it was a long time ago when I read it, but I read it a long time ago, but it was, in fact, an important book for me because it was the first time that I had read any book that explained for me exactly how open market operations work and how the Federal Reserve controls interest rates. And one of the things that I love from the Volcker administration, and for me it was an eye-opening thing. It wasn't his Saturday night special, but I think, I don't remember when it was exactly that Volcker decided that he was not going to target the interest rate, and instead he was going to target the money supply. And I thought that was, for me, that was, it seemed genius. I don't know that it necessarily was genius. Maybe it was just courageous. But to me, it gets to the heart of the issue that I think we have with interest rate policy and why we have such a destabilizing monetary policy and system is because we do not allow the interest rate to fluctuate. And I think what Volcker proved when he pegged the money supply, or he sort of focused on that variable instead of the price, which is the interest rate, is that he said to bankers, hey, listen, I'm not going to tell you that the interest rate is going to be 10%. Because you're just going to chase 10%, you know, you're going to just move your expectations upwards. I'm not going to tell you what it's going to be. I'm just going to tell you it's going to fluctuate based on daily notions of supply and demand. And so that put a risk premium into the market, the same type of risk premium that works in every other cost variable for producers, except at the core, which was credit. What do you think about that? I mean, what are your thoughts on the Volcker administration? What are your thoughts on that notion of losing volatility in the interest rate and how that affects stability in financial markets?
So I agree with you that putting risk into the market is a very healthy thing. And I think the problem with forward guidance in its modern incarnation, where you not only peg the short-term interest rate, you kind of guide people about what it will be in the future. That just makes life too cozy for people in financial markets. And they end up taking more risk. And this is the famous sort of Hyman Minsky insight, which is that people have a fixed risk appetite in life. And if you de-risk one aspect of their life, they're likely to seek more risk in some other fashion. And in financial markets, what that means is that if you take away the risk in an unexpected shift in Fed interest rates, then financiers will take more leverage and increase their risk through that method. And so you disincentivize more debt. And in my view, the whole run-up to 2008, the whole kind of enormous carry trade on subprime assets that Lehman and so forth were doing was fundamentally linked to the fact that the Fed not only held the short-term interest rate very low, making it tempting to borrow short very cheaply and then lend long by buying longer-term mortgage paper, but told the markets through forward guidance that that short-term rate wasn't going to spike against them suddenly. And that meant you could do that trade in enormous size. And that meant that people were borrowing short enormously, lending long enormously, and that dragged down the long-term interest rate, dragged down the mortgage rates, incentivized all that crazy house building and so forth. And I think too much de-risking is a bad thing, just like you say. I think, on the other hand, though, that you know, monetary targets as adopted by Volcker, worked at the time, but were not a panacea. And the reason is there's a debate about which money supply you're targeting, M3, M1, M2, what, M0.
And even beyond that, because, of course, the entire shadow liquidity in the market is not represented in any of the monetary aggregates.
Exactly. Exactly.
How do you measure derivative contracts?
Exactly.
Or something around, the BIS's estimate was $700 billion right before the crash in 2008. Where do you put that? I mean, $700 trillion. Where do you measure those?
Exactly. So we don't have a good story about, if you wanted to control supply of money, what would be the, how would you measure it, what the target would be?
And you have a central bank that was created in 1913 that is run off of a completely different financial, that was blueprinted off a completely different financial system than we have today.
Yeah, and I think one of the fascinating questions that raises about Greenspan's tenure is that, you know, he came in 1987 and was pretty successful, as I've argued, you know, fighting inflation, resisting pressure from the George H.W. Bush White House, completing the Volcker task of disinflation. You know, inflation, in fact, in 1990 was higher than 4% at one point. So it wasn't something that you would take for granted that by the late 90s it would be stable at 2. It seemed to be heading up again after Volcker's period. And, you know, a lot of people thought, as you said, that Volcker was the, you know, formidable Old Testament prophet, and Greenspan was this party-loving person who wanted to be loved. And so, you know, inflation going up and hitting 4% seemed to fit with that story, and people expected to carry on going up. So Greenspan, you know, did well in the first years to fight that expectation, drive inflation down, stabilize it. But then he should have pivoted and said, okay, what's the new challenge? We've stabilized inflation. What is the new challenge? And the new challenge was clearly that shadow banking and general leverage in the system was exploding, that mega banks were merging with each other and getting bigger and bigger and more too big to fail, and that the inflation targeting doctrine that was emerging was turning a blind eye to asset prices. And those three things together, asset price bubbles combined with a lot of leverage combined with too big to fail banks, called for a different intellectual approach, a redefinition of what the Fed's mission and challenge really was. And that's where Greenspan failed. He didn't redefine. He understood the case for a redefinition better than most other people, but he was the man who knew. He was not the man who acted.
How significant is it in that context of your comment right there that he supported and actively sort of campaigned for a revamping of CPI? Not just stuff like hedonic pricing that I was mentioning, but things like substitution bias and all these. I mean, did he really believe that the CPI was so significantly off that they needed to sort of put a downward bias on inflation at the time?
Well, there was this famous debate, at least to me, well, striking debate in 1996 when the Fed adopted a de facto inflation target. They didn't announce it publicly, but you can read the transcripts of the FOMC, the Interest Rate Setting Committee's meeting, and it's all there. So there was a debate actually between Janet Yellen, interestingly, and Greenspan about if they targeted a certain level of inflation, what should the level be? And at one point, Yellen says to Greenspan, so what do you think the desirable level of inflation would be? And Greenspan said, well, I guess no inflation, zero, if you measured it properly. And Yellen said, well, we don't measure it properly, so that means we should target 2. And the 2% target kind of emerged from that random interchange and stuck slightly. Now, wasn't totally that, because also other countries have begun to adopt 2% targets. So 2% was kind of in the air in the central banking priesthood already. But in that discussion, that's how it emerged. It was out of this point that you're making, that they understood inflation was mismeasured. And I think that's the main way that the overstatement of inflation in the official statistics played through into Greenspan's decisions?
Well, it's also, you know, it's such a interesting, it's a microcosm for me of, again, Greenspan was so cerebral and so quantitative. I mean, he was a data sleuth, as you've said many times in the book. I mean, he loved data. He was a very early adopter of technology, a very early adopter of computers for the use of statistical analysis. And yet at the end of the day, they picked 2% because it just felt right. I mean, it felt right, for lack of a better word. In some ways, the same way that, you know, Hank Paulson and the crew in 2008 picked $700 billion as the bailout because it was a big number. You know, so I think that speaks again to this other point, which is these are human beings sitting at a boardroom deciding the price of money, which is, you know, again, which makes the personal aspects of the book, the evolution of Greenspan as an individual, so interesting. So I wanted to ask you something, and this is probably an appropriate time. What do you think was, if such a thing exists, or if it's a few things, the most significant influence in Greenspan's very early development up until perhaps the age of 18? What was the most significant thing that sort of made him the man he is now? Or was it simply, as I feel based on your reading, just his nature, the nature of his biology, the way that he was temperamentally? Or was it a more Freudian analysis? I mean, you obviously mentioned his father, his mother. He was raised by his immigrant Jewish grandparents. So I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember very clearly, actually, when I was just a few months or a year into the research, having lunch with my great editor from Penguin Press, Scott Moyers, and saying, you know, Scott, I mean, surely what we care about with Greenspan is when he becomes an economist, he's an adult, he's engaging in public debates and all the childhood stuff. I know you're supposed to do that in biography, but, you know, do we really need to go there? And Scott said, well, you know, the one thing about the childhood is it's the search for the deep roots of character. And that proved actually to be very good advice, because when I focused on his childhood, I understood something which I think is relevant to how he conducted himself as chairman of the Fed. And the childhood thing is essentially captured in this self-description that he has. He calls himself a sideman, and he persisted in calling himself a sideman into his, you know, 40s and 50s, when he was, you know, a very rich person with a lot of power, and he was not a sideman whatsoever. But why did he think of himself as a guy off towards the side? And it came from this period in his life when he left high school and didn't go to college initially, and went and played in a jazz band. And he was sort of the side guy, not the central, you know, brilliant improviser, but more the kind of support saxophonist and trombonist. And he thought of himself in the side way. And I said, again, where did it come from? Well, the answer is that, you know, his father left his mother when Greenspan was just 3 years old or so.
And that was very unusual for that time, right? I mean, that was probably right. A very shameful thing to acknowledge in the 1930s.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in fact, the late 1920s, Greenspan was born in 1926. You know, his father probably left his mom around 29. So Greenspan, growing up from the age of 3 onwards, was this child of a single mother.
And during the Depression also, I think is a destabilizing thing in itself.
And there is a literature on what that does to somebody if they have a single mother who never had other kids and never remarries. So that this woman's entire emotional life, with no other person, no other husband, no other boyfriend, no other child, is entirely focused on one perfect son. And, you know, FDR's mother was a bit like that. FDR, you know, grew up as the single child of a single mother. And what you get is this massive maternal focus, which in some ways is super supportive, and you feel sort of completely self-contained because you've had all this maternal affirmation. But at the same time, Greenspan's mother was a rather ebullient, vivacious figure who would show up at family parties and lean over the piano and sing beautifully in the manner of a haunting torch singer. And Greenspan felt he couldn't compete with that level of attractiveness and that level of performance. And so he always felt off to the side of the room with his charismatic mother, whose love he depended on, you know, kind of stealing the spotlight a bit. And I think you can explain a lot of what Greenspan did in his life from that sense that he's off towards the side, he's a bit insecure, he's shy, but he knows inside that he's great because his mother says he's great. How does he get the world to recognize the greatness, which he can't just, you know, being shy, he can't just walk into a room and, you know, charm everybody. They all think he's fantastic. He's not that guy. He's the guy who has to earn external markers of greatness through diligence, hard work, application, and ambition. And so what did he do? First of all, he earned a lot of money. Then he dated a lot of beautiful women. And then he accumulated a lot of political power. And this drive to be recognized and to be move from the side to the spotlight, I think, is central to his personality.
Wow. You convinced me. You know, it's interesting because I didn't necessarily feel that way when I read your book, but hearing you say it now, I really appreciate that. In that context of beautiful women, he dated, of course, Barbara Walters, who, if you have, I mean, Barbara Walters was, and I've read her biography. I assume perhaps you have. I mean, you might have interviewed her as well. I mean, her biography is great also. I mean, very, very intriguing. She doesn't hold back, it feels, and she's really raw about it. And it's interesting, and in that context, of course, Alan Greenspan spent more than 40 years not married between his late 20s and his early 70s, right? And so he did date around, which I think is interesting, and perhaps that speaks to the whole Freudian notion of a doting mother. But of course, he had a 10-year relationship with Barbara Walters, a very long, and it would seem by all accounts to have been very loving, even though they were not married, even though perhaps they weren't even committed to each other. There was a kind of a tenderness, and I think it's captured especially in that moment that you describe at the convention in 1972 during the whole, you know, Ford Dream Ticket stuff where she, you know, she interviewed him, you know, she grabbed him. Of course, that was Barbara Walters, right? I mean, you know, such an interesting thing. I really feel like that really, to me also, and I lived in Washington. I had my television show there before this. And so I've been around that culture, and I know what that's like. And they really were the quintessential Washington couple, it feels, because it was their careers came first. And sort of, and you saw that in that moment, but you also saw that tenderness, I think, that you expressed. Let's talk a little bit about Barbara Walters, because she's a tough cookie. I mean, she's something else in her own light. I'd love to talk about that relationship. What was that like? I mean, that was right in the prime of both their lives and their careers.
Yeah, I mean, Greenspan went to, rather fittingly, a tea dance at Vice President Rockefeller's official mansion in Washington.
Nelson.
Yeah, that's right, Nelson Rockefeller, exactly. When Nelson Rockefeller was the vice president, and it was in this rather grand setting that Greenspan set eyes upon Barbara Walters, who was at the time already kind of regarded as, you know, the absolute queen of sex appeal on television news. In fact, she was once questioned, Barbara, in an interview and said, you know, do you think that the networks use you as a sex symbol? And she said, I should hope so. So she wasn't bashful about it. Greenspan sort of approached her and danced, and he was actually a very good dancer. Maybe fits with his roots as a musician on the circuit in his late teens. And, you know, he persuaded her to accept his phone number, and they got together after that. And they did date for about a decade. Now, I don't know if it was always close, because I think that it was a very, very much a kind of alliance of powerful, career-minded individuals who found each other to be useful, likable, sort of, you know, escorts to White House official events, to grand parties in New York. You know, for Greenspan to show up with a beautiful, famous woman on his arm was good for him, and for her to show up with somebody who was a sort of famous figure who'd been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers for Ford, you know, who was a well-known commentator on TV, that was good for her. And so they had this alliance going on, and I think neither of them were of a mind to decelerate their professional ambitions in order to get married or do something like that. So they were a couple, but they were, you know, there were limits to that intimacy.
That's interesting. All right, let's shift now. I think I want to ask you about everything we've discussed. I mean, you know, separate from Alan Greenspan, of course, Ben Bernanke was at the Fed when Greenspan was making these important decisions, and then he took over in 2006. And since then, we had, of course, the financial crisis, and now we have Janet Yellen, who was also at the Fed. How do you see what has happened since Greenspan left office? First, in the context of his legacy, and second, and more importantly, I think, in terms of what we can expect for the next few years. I mean, what are we really looking at? What is the legacy there?
I think it's a great question, because I think it gets to a huge issue right now in the world, which is the position of experts generally. I mean, central bank experts are exhibit A in the general faith that people used to put in technocratic specialists to make smart decisions. And, you know, the populist politics, whether you're talking about Donald Trump in the US or the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom. So populism has called into question the reputation and kind of credibility of all these experts, including people like Greenspan. And the cult of the expert was in some ways the cult of Alan Greenspan. He was the ultimate person who parlayed sort of geekish control of numbers and understanding of the economy into being a household name with a massive amount of power. He was the ultimate empowered guru. So I think what happened, you know, to your question, after Greenspan left office was that the technocratic status of the central bank that Greenspan had built up was inherited by Bernanke, inherited by Yellen, and they coasted on that. And they were able, they inherited a Fed that was held in huge high esteem, that was de facto independent, could do what it wanted. And they used that to react very aggressively after the 2008 crisis began, to create unbelievable amounts of money, you know, expand the Fed's balance sheet by whatever it was, six or seven times.
A remarkable, I mean, for you, a historian of monetary policy, de facto, if not officially, I mean, I'm familiar with some of your other previous work as well. That must be an incredible period to study.
And, you know, this is sort of almost crystallized by this interchange between Congressman Barney Frank and Ben Bernanke right after Lehman went down, when AIG, the insurance company, was about to go bust. And Bernanke went up to the Hill and told Barney Frank, look, these guys at AIG, they need $85 billion to stabilize them. Otherwise, the whole financial system's going down with them. And Frank said, $85 billion, have you got that much money? And Bernanke said, well, I've got as much as I want. I just print it. You know, I've got unlimited amounts.
Was that a quote, a close quote? I mean, I'm not familiar with that.
That is a discussion that was being reported in several different sources. I think Hank Paulson, who was also in the meeting and was the Treasury Secretary at the time, told a writer at The New Yorker, and it's come out in several different ways, different versions of this thing. But essentially, you know, that is part of the record now. It's been in several books. It's not been contested. You know, I think Bernanke would have, you know, said it right if it had been wrong. But it was, you know, clearly that's what happened. And clearly it's true that when the central bank wants to create money, there's no actual limit on how much it can print. So this extraordinary thing, you know, you can see Barney Frank thinking, $85 billion, how long would it take us to appropriate that through congressional committees and arguments and so forth? I mean, that's a huge thing. And the Fed can just click its fingers and there is the $85 billion. And so that was the ultimate high point of technocratic empowerment, I think I would argue, made possible by the Fed that Greenspan had created.
The credibility.
And the credibility around it and the sense that people would defer to it. And now what we're at is that, you know, 11 years after Greenspan left office, that credibility has played itself out a bit, and people are more willing to question the central bank and say, did it go too far? And I think the interesting thing in the next year or two is to see whether President Trump leads an attack on the Fed and sort of calls them and says, you're just unelected technocrats and why should we defer to you? Whether he decides that it's in his interest to carry on the Greenspan model of deference to the Fed.
What do you think about this notion that we're in a balance sheet recession that is very similar to the Japanese, and that no amount of monetary easing is going to get us out of it? What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think that was a important concern a couple of years ago. I think what you're seeing now is the Fed has raised interest rates a couple of times since December, and we're on a gradual tightening path, and inflation is back around target, and employment, you know, unemployment rate is 4.5%, which is way below the long-run trend. Even if you look at a broader measure of unemployment, it's below the long-run trend. So the economy in the U.S. has issues around the distribution of the income, right? Mm. There's a lot of inequality, and that's a serious, serious issue. Mm. But it does not have issues around macro performance in the sense of, you know, unemployment is okay, you know, inflation is not too low, growth is sort of okay for an economy which has got a very graying population. There's only so much growth you can really expect.
Structural demographics issue there. I think also, you know, when you're touching on something that I think is one of the ways I think about volatility in financial markets is I compare it to electoral volatility. So I think as we've suppressed volatility in financial markets, we have increased electoral volatility. That's where it's showing up. It's popping up because that inequality that we've created in income distribution and wealth is showing up in populism. I think that's where that's coming from. I think, and I'm just saying that to sort of bolster your point there. So, I mean, do you see, I mean, I'm not asking you to give a prediction, but I think it would, I mean, just to end it here, I think, I mean, do you have any, I mean, without holding your feet to the fire, do you have any thoughts about, you know, what we might see in the next year, in the next 2 years, in the next 3 years, and what the likelihood of any of those scenarios are?
You know, I think the concern is that the Fed is going to continue to raise interest rates because essentially the economy is operating at potential and growing a little bit faster than the Fed's estimate of what it could do on a sustained basis without generating inflation. So the Fed is going to raise interest rates, and that's going to support a strong dollar, because when you have high interest rates, money flows into the country because there are higher returns here, and they flow out of places like Japan or Europe that seem more stagnant. And a strong dollar means, of course, that anybody in manufacturing in the U.S. is going to get squeezed because you're less competitive against other manufacturing producers. So precisely the voters in the swing states in the industrial Midwest who supported Trump, elected Trump, those guys are going to get hit by Fed tightening leading to a strong dollar. And Trump is not going to like that. And so I think he's going to be massively tempted to come after the Fed, you know, blame the Fed for wrecking his economic program, for creating a strong dollar that he hates, for, you know, being kind of chicken little and thinking that you have to raise interest rates when growth is only around 2%. Surely it can be higher than that. Trump's official policy is it can be 4%, which is, by the way, crazy, but that's what he says on his website.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
It's so self-serving politically.
So I think where that all gets you to is that for the first time in a quarter of a century, we could be back in a period where the White House is willing to beat up the Fed and have a fight with it. And we haven't seen that since George H.W. Bush in the early 1990s. And so to understand what that's going to look like in the next year or two, you have to go back and study how it looked last time when it was George Bush versus Alan Greenspan.
It's so interesting. And to end on that note, I watched a presentation of sorts that Alan Greenspan recently gave at the American Enterprise Institute about 5 months ago. And it seems that it's so interesting. First of all, he's still very lucid, as far as I can tell. And I'm more inclined to take him at his word now, obviously, that he's not Fed chairman. It seems that he is, and I agree with him in this regard. I think some very smart people are talking about the issue of structural demographics and what role that's going to play, because I don't think that's sufficiently discussed. That seems to be big on his mind. And it seems that he is, the word he keeps using is stagflation. So I think that's a very interesting thing to note. And I think I think he's onto something there. So, Sebastian, I really appreciate you coming on. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed your book. I enjoyed this conversation. I found it very enlightening, and I think we did a good job covering a lot of it.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
And that was my episode with Sebastian Mallaby. I want to thank Sebastian for being on my program. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nicolaou. Sound engineering was Ignacio Lecumberi. Associate production, Connor Lynch. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforcespod.com. Join the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforcespod.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.